Okay, I think we should get started. We do like to start on time, so it's a pleasure to welcome Reverend Rivki Freundlich from now in Montreal, who is learning French. In the process of learning French, she'll have to have her kids teach her French. But they moved from Atlanta in 2016. Rivki teaches, I believe, at Hebrew Academy. That's sort of the main high school in Montreal, at least one of the main high schools in Montreal. Right. And she is a Yoetzet Halakha. From Nishmat, and it's a pleasure to welcome her to make her debut for our Torah in Motion. And Bevakasha, we're looking forward to your shiur.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you to all of the organizers, presenters. It's an honor to be here. Very exciting. I was looking through the double parsha for this week, and you know, sometimes you get a parsha and you're not sure, you're going to have to really dig deep to find something. But this week, there's too much to talk about. That's almost the problem that we have. And so what I want to talk about tonight with you, as we wrap up Sefer Bamidbar and move our way into Rosh Chodesh Av, and of course the 9 days, is a love of Eretz Yisrael. And the way that we are going to do that is we are going to take a look at one particular character and one particular shevet that we meet really throughout the 5 books of the Torah, but really gets highlighted in these parshios for this week of Matos Masei. And the way I want to introduce Menashe to you is actually by suggesting that I think many of us, I don't think I'm the only one, but many of us have a sort of outdated view of certain characters in Tanakh, meaning it's so easy when we're younger and we learn certain midrashim stories, the things that really stick with us, it's so easy to carry those impressions of certain people or certain events that take place in the Torah, and we carry them with us right through adulthood. And only if we stop and someone makes us think or question, do we actually wonder if we have a full appreciation of who that person or how that event took place. Right? Do we really understand them? So this reminds me a little bit of Rabbi David Foreman has often quoted in many of his essays and videos, the idea of the lullaby effect. I'm sure many of you are familiar with that, that very often we're so used to certain stories, the way that we're so used to lullabies, that we don't even stop to think about what the words mean. We don't even stop to ask questions about certain stories in Tanakh. It's like a lullaby, rock-a-bye baby on the treetop, right? And we all know how that ends. It's not a very warm and fuzzy song. And yet most of us sang it to our kids, or it was sung to us when we were children. And so I think very often we're like that with certain people and certain stories in Tanakh. An example I find was my impression of Leah. Right? As a young child in kindergarten and probably already nursery school, we learned about Rachel and Leah, and we got this impression somehow, and I don't think I'm alone in this, that Rachel was the good sister and Leah was somehow either the ugly sister or the not as loved sister, certainly when it came to their relationship with Yaakov. But even before that, we just have this tainted version of Leah. And thankfully, as we get older, hopefully we stop, we question, we wonder, and we realize that if Leah was the mother of Malchus and of the Kahuna and of so much of the leadership of our people, that obviously she is far more than what we thought about her when we were younger. And I would suggest that the same thing is true about Menashe. Maybe it's not as pronounced with Menashe, but what I'd like to do tonight is go through a couple of sources, maybe more than a couple, take a look at different views of Menashe. First, we're going to take a look at perhaps the more negative, maybe we're going to judge Menashe a little bit as both as a person and as a shevet. And then what I'd like to do is open our eyes a little bit to the very rose-colored glasses view of Menashe, to take a look at what Menashe really does teach us both as an individual, but really more as a shevet, what the people of Menashe have to teach us, why it's relevant for us. It's been relevant for us for thousands of years, what they've been teaching us all along and what they still have to teach us today. So I'm going to share my screen with you. And I was mentioning before, you don't have to just look at, let me just get this in the best view. You don't have to look at just the screen. If you want to adjust, please feel free. You can, here we go. Move everybody around so we can all see. Okay, perfect. I put the link to the source sheet in the chat if you prefer to open it that way. And let's get started. Okay, so here I have for you the two opposing views of Menashe. you'll forgive my degrading Menashe to two images that I found online. But one is the Menashe of Oive, like, oh my gosh, he's a real disappointment. And the other Menashe view of Menashe is that he's a gold medal winner. You'll notice, of course, this is a United States athlete, but he's wearing a Roots jacket. So I felt like for those from Canada, that would be a nice compromise. So which one is Menashe? Is he the guy on the left or is he the guy on the right? So let's take a look together. So the first thing we're going to look at are the psukim that where we meet Menashe, really our first impressions of Menashe, not from his birth, but as an adult. And of course, this takes us to the story of Yosef, when Yosef brings his children to meet his father, Yaakov. And it's interesting, of course, and this is not the time to discuss, but it's interesting that we know Yaakov has been in Mitzrayim for a while, and he doesn't really yet seem familiar with Yosef's children. And there's a lot of questions we can ask about this whole process, but let's just dive right in and try to move through these sources a little bit quickly so we can get to the more positive things. So right away, we see in Bereishis Parak Mem Ches, we see the story about how Yosef finds out that his father is essentially on his deathbed. And I apologize, I put only the Hebrew, but I'll make sure to translate everything. Vayomer li Yosef, hine avicha choleh, right? It was told to Yosef that now his father was sick. So vayikach et shnei venavimo, he takes his two sons with him, et Menashe ve'et Ephraim, right? The Torah then lists the two sons for us in their birth order, Menashe and Ephraim. And then we skip a few psukim and we see Yaakov is now speaking to Yosef about his children, about Yosef's children, meaning Yaakov's grandchildren. And he says, you know, your boys are very special to me. Your two sons who were born to you in Egypt, ad boi elecha mitzrayma, right, until I came down here, you already had a family. Lihem, they're going to be for me, Ephraim u'Menashe, kireuven v'shimon. Your children are going to be like children to me. And then this is the first time we see the flip in the order, whereas Yosef related to them as Menashe and Ephraim, Yaakov relates to them as Ephraim u Menashe, and he lists them, and it's very clear in the pasuk that he means almost older and younger, because Reuven and Shimon, which is the Bechor, the older, and then the second. So Yaakov already is making that switch. And of course, when he proceeds to give the brachos to his grandsons, I'll skip these few psukim, we don't have to read them inside, but he very famously crosses his hands and ends up putting his right hand, the stronger hand, the hand that represents the more significant blessing, he puts on the head of Ephraim, who is the younger son. Yosef then tries to correct his father, right? This is not the way that it's supposed to be, Abba. And Vayimain Aviv, his father, Yaakov, refuses and says, oh no, Yadati Bini, Yadati. I know exactly what I'm doing, right? And he explains that the younger one is actually going to be greater. And the younger one is going to be greater. They're both going to be good, but the younger one is going to be greater. Vayivarchem Bayomahu Leimor. And of course, he gives them the famous bracha that many people are blessed to share with their sons or were able to receive as children from their parents. Yisimcha Elokim ke'Ephraim v'cheMenashe, right? He puts again the younger before the older. Vayasem et Ephraim lifnei Menashe. In case you hadn't noticed, the Torah tells you, no, this was really purposeful. From now on, for generations to come, we will always call out Ephraim before we call out Menashe, even though that's not their order. Now, from this story alone, I think most of us have the impression that Menashe, it's not that he's bad, he's just not great. In Canada, I've learned that they say he's not bad. That's like saying he's almost good, not bad. And so it leaves you with a little bit, you know, okay, we don't have anything bad to say about Menashe, but we don't have as many good things to say about him as we do about Ephraim. So Chazal and the Psukim themselves, but really more Chazal, already begin to pick up on some negative traits of Menashe. And one of the places where we see that is in Bereishis Mem Dalet. And this, I'll give you a little background. This is the story where at the very end, right before Yosef reveals himself to his brothers, right? There's one last test that he does, right? He's sending them. He has had them bring down Binyamin. And now they're all going back to their father, all the brothers. Finally, he lets them go. And he has a servant of his plant in the sack of Binyamin, his special cup. And now they're all going to get caught. And we know that the brothers are going to feel that disaster is coming. So the pasuk says, Vayitzav et asher al beito. Yosef is commanding the person who is in charge of his house, and he gives him these instructions: place the goblet in the sack of that, you know, of that one of the brothers. And of course, what happens after this? It's terrible. It's a disaster. The brothers rip their clothes, the pasuk tells us. They go into a state of mourning. What are they going to do? How are they going to tell their father what has happened to them? And of course, this then leads to the pinnacle of the story where Yosef ends up revealing himself. But Chazal have something interesting to tell us, and that is in source number 3 here. The Medrash tells us, Menashe garam lashvatim likroa. Menashe was the cause of the tribes tearing their clothes. He's the reason why they went into a state of mourning. What Chazal are telling us is Menashe was the Asher al Beito. It's Asher al Beito, right? Yosef didn't trust anyone else with this mission. He only trusted his son Menashe. And because of that, Lefichach nitkra'a nachlato, right? We see this very often. This image, someone has written a thesis on this, but the image of tearing clothing in Tanakh is quite significant. And here is one of the examples where not only are the brothers tearing their clothing in a sign of mourning, right? Ripping, kriya, but Chazal are making a connection to the fact that many generations later, when the Jewish people have the opportunity to inherit Eretz Yisrael and to go in and capture and conquer and settle the land, that the Nachla, the inheritance of the tribe of Manasseh, is going to be torn into two. And Chazal are implying that this is a punishment. This is an element of Mida Keneged Mida, because he, Manasseh, the individual, had caused this kind of tear in the children of Yaakov, and now his own Nachla is going to be torn. Chetia be'eretz ha'yardein v'chetia be'eretz Kanan, right? So half is going to be in the land of Israel and half is going to be on the other side of the Jordan, the eastern side of the Jordan. Okay, so now things about Menashe are getting a little bit more, difficult. Let's keep going. We're going to look at two psukim in Bereishis that describe what happens right before Yaakov dies and what happens right before Yosef dies. And you'll see how this becomes relevant to Menashe. So the source number 4 shows us right before Yaakov dies, Vayitzavosan vayomer aleihem, ani ne'asaf alami, right? He tells his children, I'm about to die. Kivru oti al avosai. I want to be buried with my fathers. And then he tells them specifically, Emerasa Machpelah, right? And of course, we know that this is part of the story of the Jewish people before they are fully settled in Mitzrayim, right? They're there, the family is there, but they have this opportunity, they get permission from Paro, they go up to the land of Israel, and they bury their father there. They, of course, follow his wishes from his tzava, from his last will and testament. And then we notice that the next parak, right before Yosef dies, Vayishpa Yosef et b'nei Yisrael, right, he commands his family and says, Hashem is going to take you out of here, don't worry, and I want you, Vahalitem et atzmotai mizeh. I want you to take my bones with you. Implication being, I'm going to be buried here, and I want you to take my bones with you when you leave. You're going to be remembered. You're not going to be here forever. It's going to be a while, but you're not going to be here forever. And eventually, oh, thank you for sharing the sources. Okay. Sorry, I just took a look at the chat. Well, I'll be able to look at the chat more carefully at the end, and we'll have time for questions, hopefully. So, and then we see here what actually happens. Yosef dies after 110 years, and he is embalmed the way that they embalmed bodies back in Egypt, as we all learned about in our world history classes. Vayasem ba'aron Mitzrayim. He was buried in Egypt. Now, we know that it was a priority for Yosef to be brought to Eretz Yisrael. And he may have had all kinds of cheshbonos, all kinds of calculations, why he didn't ask to be buried in the land of Israel. But the bottom line is, we do see a difference. Yaakov insisted that he be buried in the land of Israel. And Yosef insisted that they take him with them after he's been buried in Egypt, that they should exhume his body and take him with them. On the surface, this may not be a big deal, but there are a couple of mefarshim, and I found it in the name of the Tzror Hamor, but I saw him quoted, and I have to apologize because I couldn't find it in the Tzror Hamor itself. I looked and I couldn't find it, but I didn't want to just say it. I wanted to attribute it to someone, but this is not a direct quote. This is from someone quoting the Tzror Hamor. And the Tzror Hamor says, V'ata'am she'icher l'menashe, right? And this is he is commenting on a different part of Chumash where Menasha is listed in an unusual order, where the Shvatim are listed in a normal order, but Menasha is out of place. And he says, "Lefi shelo chibev Eretz Yisrael." Why? Because Menasha, he was not a lover of Israel. V'nishar ba'aretz tmeah im gad v'ruvein. Okay, we're going to get to that in a minute. But what this is implying, and the Tzur HaMor in another place, like I said, I apologize, I couldn't find it. The Tzur HaMor comments, this is how we know. We know that Yaakov was the ultimate lover of the land of Israel because he would never allow himself to be buried in Mitzrayim. But it didn't, the level of passion that he had, the level of chiba, the level of love that he had for the land of Israel, didn't pass down to Yosef. Yosef liked Israel. He even loved Israel, but not at the level of his father. And what we're going to see is the psukim to come attribute, they always connect Menashe to Yosef when it comes to anything having to do with Eretz Yisrael. It comes up quite a bit. We'll see it a couple of examples here. Not all of the examples, but a couple. And so there is this suggestion, I would say, from the Tzur HaMor and other Mefarshim that there's something a little bit lacking in the love that Yosef had for the land of Israel, and that passed on to Menashe. Okay, so now we're getting some, I guess we would call them negative vibes about Menashe, about his passion, about his love for the land of Israel. And let's now look at our parsha for this week. So one of the, I think probably the most famous story that involves Shevet Menashe, or I should say the one that most people think of when they hear Menashe, is this story. And of course, this is the story of the 2.5 tribes, Reuven, Gad, the Chatzi Menashe, half, we'll see it's not quite half, but half the tribe of Menashe, and their request to inherit lands on the other side, what we call Transjordan, right? And that they would like to, because of all of their wealth, all of their mikneh, all of their kniot, they did a lot of shopping, it seems, then a lot of cattle, a lot of shopping, that they would prefer to stay on that side of the Jordan and not enter into Eretz Yisrael proper. And we all know that Chazal, the Midrashim, are really devastated by this request, and they put Reuven and Gad in a very negative light. We won't spend the time going through that now because that's, I think, a different topic that hopefully you've had a chance to study or you will have a chance to study. But what's instructive for us is to see that it all depends on whether Menashe chose to join Reuven and Gad or whether it was not their choice. And what we're going to see is there are obviously two different approaches to that question. So let's look at the psukim quickly, the Midbar Lamed Bet. Umikne Rav haya livnei Gad, livnei Reuven v'livnei Gad, atzum ma'ot, right? They had a lot of wealth and they see this land and wow, it looks like the perfect place for them. Pasuk bet, vayavo b'nei Gad u'b'nei Reuven, the two tribes, they come to Moshe and they put in their request. What follows after this that I didn't include here, of course, is a masterful lesson by Moshe Rabbeinu of what it means to be an educator or role model and a leader. Because for every indication that Reuven and Gad have misplaced priorities and misplaced values, Moshe very subtly teaches them what their values and priorities should be. So whereas Reuven and Gad mention their possessions first and their family as an afterthought, he reminds them that it's their children who come first and that they should be caring for their families first. He reminds them of their obligations to their fellow Jews and how they should be volunteering to be the chalutzim is the word that's used, right? To be the pioneers of helping to conquer Eretz Yisrael. And that's, again, a whole topic unto itself that really shows us how devastated both Moshe and in turn Chazal are, our sages are, with the priorities that these two Shvatim have. And then what we find towards the end of the story, where they are given, their request is granted, provided they meet certain conditions. Moshe says, Moshe vayiten lahem Moshe, pasuk lamed gimel here, he gives to them, livnei Gad, v'livnei Reuven, v'lachatzi shevet Menashe ben Yosef, right? And they are given this land that had belonged to the Amori and to Og Melech HaBashan, right? On the other side of the Jordan. Now, of course, everybody wants to know, chatzi shevet Menashe ben Yosef, where did that come from? They haven't been mentioned in the whole parak. The whole story was absent. The name Menashe never came up. And now all of a sudden, it seems that they're part of the story. So we'll focus on the Menashe ben Yosef in a moment from a positive spin. But of course, from the negative spin, we already saw that if we say that Yosef was less, I don't want to call him not a Chovev Etzion, but if he was less of a Zion lover, less of someone who was attached to the land of Israel than his father, then it would make sense that Chatzi Shevet Menashe, they joined in because they are just fine to be on the other side of the Jordan, right? Or as we'll see, there's obviously a positive way to look at it as well, but we'll get to that. I want to bring you just one approach, that of the Ramban. And the Ramban gives us the backstory. Like, where did Menashe come from in this story, right? Many of us have asked this question, and there are so many different answers. Here is one. Says the Ramban, V'lachatzi shevet Menashe ben Yosef, right? For the half of the tribe of Moshe, the son of Yosef, mitzchila lo ba'u lefanav. They didn't approach Moshe. They didn't come to him, right? Shevet Menashe, they didn't approach him. Aval, but ka'asher chile ka'aretz lishnei hashvatim. When Moshe was dividing the land and giving the land to the two tribes, ra'ah shehi eretz gedolah. It is huge. It's a massive amount of property. Yoter min hara'i lehem. And even though these two tribes had a lot of stuff, mikne rav, right? They had a lot of things. It was even too much for them. Ubikesh, so Moshe put it out there. He requested, Misha yirtzeh lihitznachel imahem. Who wants to join Reuven and Gad? He put it out there. Anybody want to join? It's like a lottery. You know who wants to join? V'hayu anashim mishevet Menashe asher yirtzuba. And there were some guys, there were some families from Shevet Menashe who wanted to settle on that side of the Jordan because Ulai, maybe they also had a lot of mikneh, right? Maybe they shared some things in common with Reuven and Gad, and maybe they felt like whatever portion they would get in Eretz Yisrael proper would never compare to what they could get, you know, like out in the suburbs. You can get much more than you can get in the city. And so maybe that's what they were thinking, and they joined. Right. And then the Ramban just mentions as an aside, which I think is an interesting point and helps explain perhaps why they're not mentioned earlier. Ha'inyan ki b'nei Menashe hayu shmoneh batei avot. There were really altogether only 8 main families in the tribe of Menashe. And what's represented here are 2 families. So by all accounts, it's 2/8. It's not really chatzi, but that's the language the Torah uses, as it does sometimes, to describe a portion instead of really half. It's not very mathematically accurate, but okay. It's 2/8 of the tribe, of the families of the tribe. And in fact, the Ramban adds, but it was only 10% of the population. So 10% of Menashe decided that they wanted to stay on the other side of the Yarden. And if that's true, what the Ramban is saying is true. And we know how negatively Moshe initially and our sages, Chazal, viewed Reuven and Gad. Well, then we can, since this group of Menashe volunteered to stay on the other side of the Yarden, well, then we can pretty much assume that whatever issues there were with Reuven and Gad, whatever negative things Chazal have to say about Reuven and Gad, about their priorities being skewed and their values being off, well, we can probably say the same thing about Menashe. So that is just a glimpse at some of the sources that give us, I would say, not the most favorable impression of either Menashe the individual or Menashe the Shevet. And some of this is even attributed to the fact that he is Ben Yosef, right? That some of this negativity really started already with the father of Menashe, who of course was Yosef, and perhaps some issues that he may have had in his, you know, passion or devotion to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel. And doesn't it then make sense that Menashe is one of the tribes that ends up not fully entering Eretz Yisrael? Okay, so as I mentioned, people are more complicated. People are more nuanced than that. They're more complex. And one of the things that we hope to do as we get older, as the years go on, is that we begin to appreciate that in the people in our lives. And we also begin to appreciate that in the people that we study in Tanakh. So let's now put on our rose-colored glasses, because we could all use some more positivity in our lives. And let's take a look at Menashe, the person, and Menashe, really more the Shevet, and see what we have to learn from the Shevet, what they were teaching us already in the times of the Torah, but what is still very instructive for us today. Okay, so the first thing we're going to look at is from the Ha'emek Davar by the Netziv, of course, who tells us that has a totally different approach than the Ramban. And I will say the Ramban is supported by quite a few Rishonim. And obviously the Nitziv is an Achron, is a later commentary, but there are quite a few Rishonim who agree with the Nitziv also. I just really like the way the Nitziv says this. And that is, he's coming from the approach that this was not Shevet Menashe's choice, right? They didn't volunteer to join. They were drafted. They were specifically chosen by Moshe for the following reason. V'nir'ah, it seems, d'bishvil shera'a Moshe Rabbeinu, right? It seems that Moshe saw something. D'be'ever hayardein, on the Transjordan side of things, koach ha'Torah me'at. Torah was going to be weak on that side. Whatever, we're not talking about Reuven and Gad, but whatever it was about the tribes of Reuven and Gad that gave Moshe this impression, he was concerned for the level of Torah, Torah learning, Torah observance. There would be a weakness in Torah on that side of the Jordan. Al Kain, therefore, hishtadel, he sought, he tried, lahashtil bekirbam gedolei Torah. Such beautiful language. He sought to plant, right? Like a shtili, like shtilim. He sought to plant within their midst great men of Torah, giants of Torah, sheya'iru mechashkei ha'aret b'or koach shalahem, right? So poetic, so beautiful, that he understood that Reuven and Gad on their own side of the Yarden by themselves was going to be a disaster. Assimilation of Avodah Zarah, all sorts of things. We don't know what could happen. We do know what does happen. And it's not a great story, right? That we know that these 2.5 tribes are the first to be exiled. They are punished first. We know a few things, other things about them that we learn actually later on in this week's parsha, where just as an aside, I'll mention, we learn about the Arei Miklat, right? The cities of refuge. We learn about all the cities that will be given to the Levium, who are not given proper boundaries within Eretz Yisrael. They're given cities, 42 cities for Levium, plus 6 Arei Miklat, 6 cities of refuge. 6 cities where if somebody were to kill someone accidentally, then the accidental murderer would have a place to run where he would be safe from the victim's family, who it seems have a right to chase the accidental murderer down and kill them. And so these cities of refuge, the Arei Miklat, are meant to be the place where these people can go. And one of the things that is quite jarring when you realize is that while there were 6 cities altogether, there were 3 in Eretz Yisrael proper and 3 on the other side of the Yarden. And it doesn't take a mathematician to understand, you don't have to do major studies on population to understand that something about that is very wrong. And Chazal and many commentaries right away jump up and say, that doesn't make any sense. Why do you need the same numbers of cities of refuge where you only have 2.5 tribes versus where you have 9.5 tribes? And of course, they see in this something very, very negative, that there was an overall lack of appreciation for the value of life, and that crime, even accidental crime, is the cause of people being careless and not having the values in order. And so they attribute that to the fact that the lack of, we'll call it lack of Torah leadership that existed. And so Moshe understood that things could go in a wrong direction, and he wanted to bolster the Torah learning and the Torah observance of those 2 tribes. Therefore, he assigned them the tribe of Menashe. And so what does that tell us right away? Menashe are Gedolei Torah, right? They had the Rashi Yeshiva, the Magidei Shir. They were the ones who were leading at least aspects. We know that the Levium did this as well, but they were clearly part of the Torah leadership of the Jewish people. This is already a very different view of Menashe. And perhaps he specifically chose these 2 families from Menashe because they were the ones that really carried the torch of Torah, and they would really be able to have a positive influence on their brothers from Reuven and Gad. So that's one thing. In source number 10, we see yet another approach. And this approach, I couldn't find the Sefer Ner Lama'or by Rav Neria. I couldn't find it online, and we don't own it. So I brought it quoted from the Birkas Asher. The Birkas Asher is a commentary that I had not heard of until I discovered it on Sefaria. It was written by Rav Asher Wasserthal. And he quotes some phenomenal modern day and not so modern day sources. It's a beautiful, beautiful commentary that I've I don't own, but again, I found on Sefaria, so I'm sharing it with all of you. And he quotes Rav Neria, Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria Zatzal, of course, was a very close Talmud of Rav Kook, who explains much of what Rav Kook wrote to the rest of us who otherwise wouldn't understand it, was one of the founders of Bnei Akiva, and, you know, obviously contributed a tremendous amount to the state of modern Israel. So let's look at what he has to say. Hanimuk liyazmato shel Moshe Rabbeinu, right? The depth of the motivation, the plan for Moshe, biyishuv chatzi shevet Menashe be'eva ha-yardein. Why did, what was motivating him to add this half tribe of Menashe, right? On the Mizrahi, on the eastern side. Haya lo rakidei lehosif l'uklas, uchlusiyat ever ha-yardein ha-mizrahi yisod enoshi, Torani, Ruchani, Eitan, right? It wasn't just to bolster the spiritual, the Torah, the foundation of that eastern side of the Jordan. Elagam kidei lechazek et hazika. He also wanted to strengthen the connection, the affinity, shel b'nei Ruvain v'gad le'ever hayardein hama'aravi. That Moshe understood if he put two complete tribes on one side of the Jordan and 10 on the other, they would become completely detached, right? That river would create quite, would become quite the boundary, and there would be a separation amongst the 12 tribes. And there would be no connection so that the people on the eastern side would just lose their love for the land of Israel because they would have their own land. Okay, we'll skip this part, right? And this is why he chooses Shevet Menashe. And he quotes, L'chatzi Shevet Menashe, Ben Yosef. Why did Moshe know he needed to send someone from Menashe? So not necessarily because they were the Torah learners and Torah teachers, although he's not negating that, but he's adding because Yosef was known as one of the Chovevei Tzion, right? He loved Eretz Yisrael. And so Menashe, who grew up, as the Psukim tell us so beautifully in Bereishis, about how Menashe and Ephraim used to sit on their father's lap, right? The Torah specifically tells us how Yosef had to take the boys off of his knees, although they were men at the time, so I'm not sure about that. But I think the Torah is trying to explain to us there was a lot of education, a lot of chinuch, a lot of connection between Yosef and his children. And therefore, the idea of adding Menashe to Reuven and Gad was in order that somebody else who was gonna fly the flag of Israel and was going to be connected to Eretz Yisrael would be living amongst Reuven and Gad. And therefore, they could never become totally separated from Eretz Yisrael because everyone from Menashe loved Eretz Yisrael. So they're like shlichim, I guess we would say, right? These are the messengers from the land of Israel. They never got to settle there, but they were the ones who were going to sort of represent Eretz Yisrael, even me'ever le'yardein, even on the eastern side of the Jordan, right? Ki yitachein shezu gam hasiba l'chalukat shevet Menashe l'shnei chalakim. And then he adds another fascinating point. This is also probably why he did half a shevet. Right? Why didn't he just give them all of Menashe? It sounds like they needed a lot of help. So why didn't he give them the whole Shevet? Because Chilukah shel Nachla b'nei Menashe, ben Shnei Evrei HaYardin, right? Splitting the inheritance of the tribe of Menashe to both sides, Machriach sheyihiyu hashayarot mitzuyot ben Shtei HaNachalot. Because this was going to guarantee that there would be caravans, modern day word, there would be caravans of Menashe on both sides of the Jordan. Umimela, and therefore, like what would come from this, Yishmor HaKesher, Ben Shnei Evrei HaYardin. What would happen if half of Menashe is in one place, or 2/8 of Menashe is in one, and the other part of the Shevet is somewhere else? They're going to go visit each other. They're going to have each other over for Chagim. Right? There's going to be a constant back and forth. They'll never be fully separated because it's family, close family. We know all of Klal Yisrael is one big family. All the Shvatim, we're all family. We all love each other, of course. But those people who all came from Shevet Menashe, right? That's, we assume, cousins, brothers, sisters, they're going to get together. And therefore, Moshe, in his wisdom, understood, and this is clear, this is not Hashem's idea, this is attributed all to Moshe, his brilliant leadership. He understood they needed, according to the Nitziv, they needed Torah leaders. And according to Rav Neria, they also needed that family connection that would allow them to not become totally separated from the rest of Bnei Israel. And it would also allow them to maintain their connection to Eretz Israel. Both of those things were part of this, right? And he says here, Yishmor HaKasher, right? But Tishmor HaZika, the Hachiba, the affinity and the love for Eretz Yisrael, Kula, right? The whole thing would therefore still be a living presence amongst the tribes of Reuven and Gad. Okay, so now we're getting a totally different vision of Menashe, the Shevet of Menashe, and what the individual Menashe must have given to his children. So now I'd like to look at two stories that are really two parts of the same story, one that we read last week in Parashas Pinchas about the Benos Tzafchad, the daughters of Tzafchad. And then we're going to take a look at sort of the follow-up to that story that actually ends Sefer Bamidbar. It's actually, right, it's one of the last things that we read before we close this book. And so just to review the story, we're going to take a look at the psukim inside. We're going to notice some really strong parallels in the language between the two stories. We're going to see what this teaches us and see what the tribe of Menashe, it turns out, can teach us. And I didn't realize this right away, but what this essentially is like the women's side of the mechitza and the men's side of the mechitza, right? So we're first going to take a look at the women from Menashe within Benot Tzafchad, and then we're going to take a look at the men. So this is the story of the five daughters of Tzafchad, who we won't talk about who he was and all the different commentaries that suggest who he was, but he was an individual that clearly died in the desert and left no sons to inherit, so that when it came time to divide up the land of Israel, his family was stuck. And the daughters, the five daughters that are named in the Torah and who are praised literally from beginning to end by Chazal, by the sages, and by all the commentaries, they're talked about in the Gemara. They are described as Tzidkanios, Chachmanios. There's like the words used to describe these five women are really of the highest caliber. They were extraordinary in every way. And if we had more time, we'd talk more about them, but we don't. So let's take a look. Vatikravna benot Tzafchad, right? So the daughters of Tzafchad, Vatikravna, they come close, right? And who was Tzafchad? Tzafchad, by the way, was the son of Chefer, who was the son of Gilad, who was the son of Machir, who was the son of Menashe. Menashe, who was from Yosef, okay? And then it names us the five, I don't want to call them girls, they're women. And Vata'amodna, they then come, and Chazal have so much to say about all of these words, it's hard not to go into it, but we're going to skip it for tonight. Vata'amodna, they come and they stand, Lifnei Moshe, V'lifnei Elazar HaKohen, V'lifnei HaNesim, V'chol Ha'eda. So when they approach Moshe and everyone else, it's quite a scene. Right away, the commentaries tell us, and I think I have this later here. Let me just scroll down a bit. Yeah, let's just look here quickly at the Torah Tamima that tells us, Vatikravna benot Tzafchad. What does it mean that they drew close? So does it mean that they came to Moshe? No, it doesn't seem that way, because Vata'amodna is when they're standing in front of Moshe. So what does Vatikravna tell us? Kevan sheshamu benot Tzafchad. As soon as the daughters of Tzafchad heard, Sheha'aretz mitchalaket l'shvatim, that the land was now going to be divided up amongst the tribes, the lonely nekevot, and there was no room for girls, they were not getting any inheritance, nitkabtsu kulan litol itza. They gathered amongst themselves to discuss how they should handle it. And they said to themselves, amru, to each other, I should say, lo karachame basar vadam rachame HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem's not like people. Basar vadam rachamav ala zacharim. People tend to have more rachmanus on men. I don't think this is necessarily an accurate statement, but okay, from their impression, they felt like when it came to the laws of nachala, when it came to inheritance, the system was the old boys network, right? So, and there was going to be no place for them. Yoter me'al nekivot, aval HaKadosh Baruch Hu, oh, I see it got a little cut off. Aval HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I believe it says, rachamav al kol ma'asav, right? Like we say in Ashrei, he has rachamim on everybody. So why am I sharing this with you? Because this idea of Vatikravna means that they got together and they had a real open and honest conversation with them amongst themselves, deciding how they were going to handle this situation. And one of the things we'll note about what is said about the Benot Tzafchad is that they approach Moshe and everyone else with a tremendous amount of derech eretz and kavod. They are to say it about women. They're menschlich, right? They come with, they are sincere, clearly, in their request. But even beyond that, they just express themselves so respectfully. And this is how they make their point. Our father, Avinu Meit Bamidbar, he died in the desert, right? And they go on to say he died, but he has no sons, right? And then they say, Lama Yigara Shem Avinu Mitoch Mishpachto. Why should the name of our father go missing? Why should it be lacking from amongst his family, right? Just because he has no son, right? Tana Lanu Achuza Bitochachei Avinu. Give us land. Allow us to inherit the land, so that it doesn't get lost amongst, you know, another family. This is not right. We want to perpetuate the name of our father. And of course, Moshe, it's interesting. It's Vayakrev, the same language as Vatekravna, right? So Moshe asks Hashem what he should do. That's a whole other discussion. And Hashem says, Kain b'notzlafcha dovro. They speak correctly. They speak properly, right? And then he instructs Moshe, this is going to be the halacha. This is going to be the law. Of course, Rashi here tells us, that this shows us, I see I didn't bring that part of Rashi, but Rashi here very famously says, Megagalin zuchus al yedei zakai, right? This law of women being able to inherit when there are no sons, well, that could have been taught by anybody. It was going to eventually be taught by Moshe. He was going to teach that halacha. He knew that that was the case. But Benot Slavchad were so extraordinary and they had such merit that they brought this halacha down, so to speak. It was through them that this law was taught and that it came to be taught to all of the Jewish people. And of course, this tells us something amazing about the Benot Slavchad. What does Rashi tell us about the Benot Slavchad? Well, he says, no wonder. Why does it tell us that Menashe is the son of Yosef? Like, this is information we all know already by this point in the Torah. Lama ne'mar, v'halo kvar ne'mar b'nei Menashe? Didn't we know this? Ella lomar lecha, to teach you, Yosef chibev et ha'aretz, right? So here we have Yosef again on the team as a lover of Eretz Yisrael. And he taught to his children a love of Eretz Yisrael that got passed on to the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, right through his son, his grandson, Machir, and Yosef's grandson, Machir. And it continued to pass down to the family. One pasuk that I didn't bring for you earlier in Sefer Bereishis actually tells us that Machir was one of the grandchildren that Yosef knew, meaning Yosef was alive while his children raised their families, not all of them and not probably not the next generation, but the Torah goes out of its way to tell us that Machir, that grandchild and his family was one of the generations that Yosef himself saw. And so we have like real textual proof that Menashe is carrying this passion and love for the land of Israel that he would have learned from his 80, from Yosef, right? It was something Yosef was passionate about. The end of this week's parsha, at the end of Maaseh, we have an interesting follow-up to the story of Benot Slavchad, which again, by all accounts, is a great, great story. What ends up happening, though, at the end is a concern that is expressed by the men of Menashe. So we've heard from five women from Shevet Menashe, and now we're going to hear from some of the men. And listen to this. I never noticed this before. Vayikrivu Rashei Ha'avot L'mishpachat B'nei Gilad Ben Machir Ben Menashe Mimishpachot B'nei Yosef. Again, same lineage going all the way back. Who's now coming and who's drawing close? Who is getting together as a group and making sure that the way they're going to express themselves is appropriate and respectful, right? They're going to talk to each other and bounce off their ideas. Like, are we doing this for the right reasons? Or do we just have like a personal vendetta or a personal issue that we're trying to, you know, to put forth? Is this subjective or objective, right? They go through the same process that Benot Slavchad went through to assess themselves and make sure that when they do approach Moshe, they're going to do it in a way that is appropriate. And again, same lineage is mentioned for the same reason, because these are also people that are mechavevei ha'aretz. They love Eretz Yisrael. And they speak, again, same language, lifnei Moshe, v'lifnei ha'nasim, rashei avot libnei Yisrael. They come, they approach Moshe and everyone else who's there. And they say, Moshe, and they speak to him, right? Adoni, right? Vayomru et Adoni tziva Hashem latet et ha'aretz b'nachala, right? They speak, of course, in third person, appropriately, you know, to my master. They speak to Moshe and say, Hashem told our master that women are now going to inherit land from our tribe, right? That Slavchad's daughters are going to inherit. But what's going to happen, they say, V'hayula achad mibnei shiftei b'nei Yisrael l'nashim. What happens when these women, now one of the amazing things we discover about the Bnos Lafchad is they hadn't gotten married yet. And it seems, according to Mefarshim and according to Chazal, they waited. It's not because they weren't a great catch, but as we know, unfortunately, lots of people have to wait to find their match. And the Bnos Lafchad, according to Chazal, the youngest one was 40 when she got married. And they merited tremendous nisim and tremendous brachos the way that Yocheved did, Moshe's mother, who was very old when she first gave birth. And the same types of things are written about the daughters of Slafchad, but they waited to get married because they wanted to make sure they did everything right. They wanted to make sure that A, they found men that were appropriate and were, you know, on their level, so to speak. But there was also some tension about how this was going to work. And so the men of Menasha, this is what they're expressing. What will happen if the daughters of Tzavchad marry men from other Shvatim, right? If it goes through the father, then this land, as soon as these women get married, will go to their sons who are going to go by their new husband's Shevet, their father's Shevet, sorry. It's the exact same claim that Benot Tzavchad made. You see the language of Vinigra'a, Yigara, right? Many times they say it here and they say it again here, Nachalatenu Yigara, and then they say it again, Minachalat Matea Botenu Yigara. They are very worried about lacking. And again, it's not we are going to be lacking, it's that our Shevet, right? The families that we come from are going to end up getting the short end of the deal. So what should we do? So Moshe, of course, says in the name of Hashem, exact same language. Cain, Matei, Bnei Yosef, Dovrim, right? They were Dovrot, the men are Dovrim, right? And it's just fascinating what we are learning from both the women, and then it seems like the men are maybe even picking up on this method of the women who approach with so much respect and who everything they say, and it seems everything they're requesting is L'shem Shamayim, is all for the sake of heaven, or L'shem Nachlat Eretz Yisrael, right? It's all for the, out of this love for the land of Israel. So not only do the women of Menasha, the daughters of Tzavchad, merit to have this law of inheritance, this special law of inheritance taught through them. But the flip side of that law is, as is mentioned later in Bamidbar Lamed Vav, is that when women inherit from their father because there are no sons, they have to marry men from their Shevet, right? And we can argue that this sounds, oh, that's so unfair. That really seems terrible. But I would put it in the category of, you know, the limitations on a Kohen and who he's allowed to marry, right? So however we might want to understand that, this is along those same lines. In order to preserve the sanctity and the connection of every Shevet within Bnei Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael, this is a modification of the law that allows it to continue, that the women can inherit, provided that they will marry within their own Shevet, so that the Nachla stays within each Shevet. So we see here, not only do we see the leadership of Menashe in teaching Torah, their love of Eretz Yisrael, which we hope will be a good influence on Reuven and Gad, the fact that they're also a Shevet that clearly they would be keeping up the connection, and the hope is that would also maintain the connection between Reuven, Gad, and the other tribes. But now we're seeing that this is a Shevet that really understands how to approach authority. They really understand how to deal with a very charged issue, right? Imagine all the different times in our lives when we're faced with challenges, financial, which this certainly is, emotional, which this certainly is, things that involve our family, our family's name, or an inheritance, which we know so often can cause so much pain in a family and in a community. And look at how well they handle themselves. Look how they express themselves, how they gather themselves. They check themselves, make sure that they are always L'shem Shamayim. They speak beautifully with respect and Derech Eretz, and they merit to have these aspects of Jewish law taught through them. Two more quick ideas, and then we'll wrap up. We did this Rashi already. Oh, we even did the Torah Tanima. Perfect. Okay. So what I would like to do now is just add one more point. One more point to what we've seen about Menashe so far. And for this, we are going to back to this Birkas Asher that I found, who quotes the following. He quotes Reb Shmuel Emanuel. Now, I had to do some research, but this I was able to find. Reb Shmuel Emanuel, who he quotes here, Sheyichya, but since the printing of this, he has passed away. I think he died about 5 years ago. And what I discovered about Reb Shmuel Emanuel is that he was a Holocaust survivor. He and his family, he was one of eight, and he and his family, many of whom perished in the Holocaust, he and at least his brother, Yona, Rav Yona Emanuel, made it to Eretz Yisrael and raised their families there. They were a family who I wasn't able to read the full story, but their family's stories of tremendous self-sacrifice, both for Torah and for their fellow Jews, were written up by this Rav Shmuel Emanuel and his brother, Rav Yona, in a sefer called Yisupar, I wrote it down, Yisupar Hador, Yisupar Hadavar, something like that. And this Reb Shmuel Emanuel, after I did some Googling in Hebrew, I discovered that he was one of the founders of Kibbutz Shalavim and eventually of Yeshivat Shalavim, which has a special place in my heart, and I imagine for other people as well, a very unique and wonderful Makom Torah, a very special place. And so this is what Reb Shmuel Emanuel has to say. And I shared with you his background because when we hear what he's going to say and the insight that he has, it gave me goosebumps when I read it, when I thought about what he and his family went through, right? So he went through several concentration camps and eventually made his way to Eretz Yisrael and was one of the founders of one of the most successful communities in the land of Israel. So this is what he has to say about Menashe. Chibat ha'aretz hi achein inyan shel chinuch babayit. Love of Israel is something that is taught at home. It's something that you get from your home, from your family. Aval nishal et ha-sheila, but we could ask the question, ha'im b'nei Yaakov ha'achirim lo kiblu v'bayit chinuch l'chibat ha'aretz? It's so nice that we're talking about Menashe being this lover of Israel, but there were 12 tribes and Menashe is even, right? He's not one of the original 12. He's like next generation. So why is there all this connection to Menashe? Madua. Tshuva, listen to this. Yosef ve'Osnat, right? Yosef and his wife Osnat. Osnat, according to Chazal, was the daughter of Dina and was the wife of Yosef, right? For another time. But Yosef and his wife Osnat, who was also potentially the daughter of Potiphar, according to other Mamari Chazal, they lived in Egypt, right? They were in Mitzrayim. Yadu, and they knew. She'im heim lo ya'aniku, Lemenashe ve'Ephraim, chinuch l'chibat ha'aretz. They knew if they didn't give over to their children, Menashe and Ephraim, a tremendous love for the land of Israel, if they didn't make that part of their chinuch, part of their education, lo tihiyeh lahem ahavat eretz Yisrael. They weren't going to get it from the neighborhood, right? This was not something that they were expecting their children to learn at school. They understood that this was a responsibility that rested solely on their own shoulders. Li'umatam, and opposite them, or I should say, as opposed to them, B'nei Yaakov, the children of Yaakov, Shechayu be'eretz Kanan, all the other ones, all the other children who lived in the land of Israel, Chashvu se'et b'neihem hagdelim v'chayim ba'aretz. They raised their kids in Eretz Yisrael. They just kind of thought, ein sorech l'chanik l'chibat ha'aretz. They live in Israel. They breathe the air of Israel. They drink the water of Israel. They keep the mitzvos of Eretz Yisrael. Why do we have to tell our kids that they need to love the land of Israel? And what he's suggesting is the parents didn't take as much responsibility for making sure that their children loved and the land of Israel, were passionate about the land of Israel, the way the parents in Chutz La'aretz, the way the parents in the exile made sure to teach their children. Hamaskana hachashuva v'ha'aktualit, right? So what is the conclusion? What's the practical conclusion? Gam le'iladim hagdelim v'chayim ba'aretz. Even for those children who are being raised in the land of Israel, chayavim la'anik chinuch b'chibat ha'aretz u'la'avat eretz Yisrael. Right? We can never, and we know this as parents, we know that this is true in the world of education and in the world of parenting. Nothing is muvan me'ilav. We can't take for granted that our kids are just going to pick it up from the air or from cyberspace. We know they're not going to get so many good things. They'll get some good things from there, but that a parent's job, a teacher's job, and certainly a parent's job is to articulate and focus and highlight the values that they want their children to pick up on. And even when it comes to the love of Eretz Yisrael, which I imagine everybody who's watching this year is in Chutz La'aretz with me, that even even for all that we love Israel and we talk about it and we try to make it a priority, and we always feel like we fall short. We always feel like, but if we lived there, we wouldn't have this problem. Says Rav Emanuel, parenting doesn't go away just because you move to Eretz Yisrael, right? And I've certainly, I don't know about you, but I have had this conversation with so many friends of mine who have either made Aliyah or are Israeli from birth, that the responsibility that parents take upon themselves when they're raising their children outside of the land of Israel, it's so much more present. And granted, I think it's from guilt. I think it's because we feel like, oh my gosh, we really have to make sure they get the message. And that's something that sometimes the parents in Israel might forget to tell their children. And says Rav Emanuel, don't make that mistake. Obviously, for those of us in Chutz La'aretz, we have a lot of work to do in many areas as well. But here is another way that we look at Shevet Menashe and we say, oh my gosh, you have so much to teach us, right? You were chosen as the tribe to keep the two tribes of Reuven and Gad connected to the rest of Israel. You were chosen to be the ones to inspire them religiously, to inspire them for a love of Israel, to keep them connected to the Jewish people. But they are also our models in how we approach a problem, how we approach authority, and they are our models for chinuch habanim, for education of our children, that when it comes to making sure that our children are going to get the most important messages, what are our values and what do we find we really want them to walk away with when they leave our homes, that is something that we 100% have to take an active responsibility in. And in particular, as we're going into the 9 days, it certainly feels appropriate to be mechazik ourselves, to strengthen ourselves in remembering that this is our job, right? This is something that both for ourselves and for the next generation, whether we are parents or we are teachers or we are community members or citizens of whatever countries we are, that this is without a doubt a full responsibility for us to make sure that we are conscious of articulating what our values are and trying very much to pass them on to the next generation. We should, God willing, have the opportunity to do that. In Eretz Yisrael, we should face this challenge that the other children of Yaakov had, that we have to take that responsibility to educate our children about a love for the land of Israel, and we should just be there and have that challenge. So thank you all so much for being here tonight. Thank you for having me. I'm going to look at the chat and see if there are questions. If anybody wants to pipe in and ask questions, go right ahead. I'm going to take it from the top here. I'll read along and see. Okay, so fulfilling Kibbut Av, Menashe is punished. Interesting. It could be, like we say in a lot of situations, and I don't know for sure what the answer to this is, right? Someone's wondering, going back to that source about how Menashe was the one who carried out his father's wishes, that he placed the goblet in the sack of Binyamin. Sometimes people are not punished for what they do, but for how they do it. And if you go back and look at those psukim, there's quite a nasty conversation that takes place between this unnamed individual who Chazal say is Menashe and the brothers. Like, he maybe makes it even more emotional and even more devastating. He yells at them. It's a very unpleasant scene. So maybe that has something to do with it. Okay, so I think we got to that one. So if Yosef didn't care for Israel as much as his father, can the same be said for Reuven and Gad? I think that is another conversation for sure, right? Where did we go wrong with Reuven and Gad? Because clearly there's an issue there. And where did that stem from? I don't know, do we want to blame it all on Yosef? I guess we could, but I think we'd have to look at Reuven as a character in the Torah, where there's a little bit more to learn about, and Gad also, because Yaakov gives us a little bit of insight into Gad when he gives him the brachos about him being a bit of a loner, maybe, right? Gad Gadud, right? So I think that's something to look at. Okay, the Or HaChaim HaKadosh attributes the desire of Benot Tzlafchat to inherit the land fact that they are from the tribe of Menashe and Yosef. Exactly. Okay, so someone was sharing some of the ideas that we shared about the positives about Rashi. I think the Or HaChaim also makes a similar comment. Commenting on Rashi. Okay, let's see. Menashe, the first Shlichim, totally, 100%. Okay. Was the Jordan River really such an impediment to being part of Bnei or Eretz Yisrael? The Nile is much bigger and unified Egypt, both along the banks. Right, that is a good question. Listen, crossing the Jordan River is a big deal. We know it required a miracle, right? The Yarden split in order for the Jews to get across when they actually went into Eretz Yisrael. And what goes on, it's an interesting thing that I haven't really looked at enough, but I did have an occasion when I was preparing for this to look at some of the psukim that talked about, I think it's in Sefer Yoshua, where after Reuven and Gad get themselves settled, they build a mizbeach, on their side of the Yardin. And the other Shvatim go crazy. Well, you're already worshiping idols? Like, what's happening? And the Shvatim on the eastern side get very upset. What do you mean? We're building a Mizbeach for Hashem. We want our children to know that, like, we're connected to you guys. Like, we're part of Eretz Yisrael. But you see already that that separation was significant. And I think we know that when people are geographically separated, it could be, I don't know, two blocks away. I don't have to cross the river, but I do not see the people who live two blocks away as much as I see my next door neighbors. So I think it requires effort. And I think that's the key here, is that we wanted to make sure that Reuven and Gad would make the effort. Yes, they are definitely smart women. Okay, why did Moshe encourage them to move over to Jordan? Shouldn't he encourage them to stay and convince them? That is a really good question. I saw quite a few Ma'amari Chazal, a few comments from the sages about what, both positive and negative, about the conquering of the land on the eastern side of the Jordan. And that really, and there's a whole, I think, halachic discussion about this that I'm not equipped to talk about the different levels of Kedusha, right? Because that part of really what's biblical Israel does have a level of Kedusha. And there's a huge debate. Does it have the same level of Kedusha as the other part? So I think we could almost ask the opposite question, like, why didn't we put more tribes there? Why didn't we make sure that it really would become part of Eretz Yisrael? Like, we need bigger borders, right? We want there to be room for everybody. But I think you can ask the question probably both ways. And it seems, right, Hashem approves they are staying on that side of the Yardin. So there's a lot of discussion also about the might, the physical power of those tribes and how they were real warriors. And that maybe they would also serve as a buffer zone with the enemies on that side of the Yardin after they conquered the tribes, the nations that they conquered. But it's maybe a good idea to have tribes like Reuven and Gad, who were strong, to have them there as a buffer, because on the other side, right? I mean, granted, north and south, we know Israel has plenty of enemies, but on the all the way to the west, it's no, you know, it's the water. But the Jordan, as somebody pointed out, is not as daunting a thing to cross. And so perhaps having them there would serve as a bit of a buffer for enemies from the eastern side. Okay. If there are no other questions, I wish you all a wonderful night. Of course, a good Shabbos. And may this be, hopefully we won't even have a Tisha B'Av outside of the land of Israel, but if God forbid we do, I hope this is our last one in Chutz La'aretz, and we should all gather together to learn together in Israel, God willing, very soon. Thanks so much for being here. Have a wonderful night. Shabbat Shalom. Good Shabbos.
Thank you very much. We have a lot of work to do not to have a Tisha B'Av. That's, but anyways, that's a whole other story. But since
I'm feeling very hopeful and positive, there's a lot of good things,
There are a lot of good things, but okay, we'll discuss that on Tisha B'Av, because we got 8 hours of programming.
Yeah.
I haven't sent out an email about that, but we'll, you know, be mentioning, we'll be having an all day program beginning 11 a.m. in the morning, till about 7 at night. So, keep you busy. You get tired, you can come, you can fall asleep in the middle, turn off your camera, and no one will notice, as long as you don't eat a hamburger in the middle. Of course, unless you live in Israel, and then it'll be over, the fast will be over in the middle of the day. Anyways, that's next Sunday. And of course, this Sunday is our medical ethics conference that I encourage even the non-doctors to come. It's really a wonderful program. David Pelkovitz, Avram Steinberg, Eddie Reichman, Aaron Glatt. It's really join us. Then we have the panel in the evening. So that's this Sunday, 9 till 1:15, and then 7 till 9:30. I'm giving Shir Tumor Perkei Avot, 9:30. And on Monday, Rabbanit Shira Mervis will begin her series, 5-part series on the Islam leaders, from rabbinic leaders from the Islamic world. So that begins Monday at 11 before Alex Israel's class and Jonathan Sachs. And I think that's a new class coming up, and we look forward to seeing you. And Shabbat Shalom, and thank you, Rifki, and a pleasure, and all the best. And okay, bonjour. No, that's okay. And all right, everybody, Laila Tov, and be well, and Shabbat Shalom.
Thanks so much. Have a good
Thank day. You. Thank you, Rifki. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rifki.
Thank you, Rifki. Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here.